My name is Jordan Ross, and thanks for listening to What's Your Limp? I'm an actor and the host of this podcast, but I also happen to have cerebral palsy and scoliosis, resulting in a limp. That limp led to vicious bullying in high school, limited opportunities as an actor, a number of insecurities, and severe depression. However, over time, I slowly learned to open up about my feelings, which showed me that I'm not alone, because the more I opened up, the more others opened up to me. I quickly learned that everyone has a limp, whether it's physical or internal. I stopped seeing my limp as a weakness and began to see it as an asset. And that's the goal of this podcast, is to help others do the same. So, as you listen to my conversations with some of your favorite actors, athletes, singers, and public figures, listen closely, because you might just find out that some of them struggle with the exact same limp as you. So let's all learn to love our limps together. What is up, my fellow limpers? This is your host, Jordan Ross, and thank you for listening to another episode of the What's Your Limp podcast. Today, I am really excited to be talking to actor and writer Will Wheaton, who was one of the biggest influences on me as a child whenever I discovered my passion for acting. It was Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, and Henry Thomas that were the kid actors I looked to whenever I was imagining myself pursuing this as a career. I was super grateful that he agreed to come on here and chat with me for a bit. And it was kind of surreal too, considering the fact that Will Wheaton's, you know, big break was Stand By Me, and that is arguably my favorite film of all time. But it was really, really insightful to talk to Will about the making of that film, the parallels in his own life, and as well as his castmates and a bunch of other really, really interesting stuff. And he was incredibly vulnerable and open, which is what this podcast is all about. So I was really grateful for that as well. And I just can't wait for you to hear this conversation with Will. But also, before I get started, I just want to, again, promote my upcoming live podcast show with my chosen castmates, Elizabeth Tabish and Paris Patel, who play Mary Magdalene and Matthew. It is going to be on July 31st at 4 p.m. at Arlington Music Hall. Tickets are going pretty fast. We've sold a little over 100 with little to no promotion. But here pretty soon, I'm going to be gearing up on all of that. And I am going to be making some TV appearances, doing some interviews on local news stations, as well as radio interviews, maybe even some newspaper ads as well. So I expect ticket sales to start ticking up here pretty soon. So if you want a good seat, just go to arlingtonmusichall.org and scroll down to our event, which is on July 31st again, and be sure to secure your tickets now before all of the good seats are taken. Anyway, now that I got that out of the way, sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with one of my biggest inspirations, actor and writer Will Wheaton. There we go. Sorry about that. I was trying to, for some reason, it wasn't letting me like start the meeting, and it kept saying you joined, but then I couldn't accept it. So
I have experienced, if there is a way that Zoom can cause a problem or be unreliable over the last 2 months, I have firsthand experienced virtually every possible way Zoom can fail.
Right.
So no worries.
Good.
I'm glad that we're able to connect.
Yeah, same here. I really appreciate you doing this. And before I get into all the questions, I just want to say that you and, you know, Henry Thomas and River Phoenix, like, you were the guys that made me want to act.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, growing up watching all of you and your careers, and you just... All three of you offered like an endless supply of inspiration for me. So,
That's cool.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
You know, I do want to Stand By Me is one of my all time favorite films, and there's a lot I want to ask about that. But before, I know that you have been open about, you know, the way you got into acting and kind of feeling the pressure and stuff from your mother. So can you kind of, like dig into how that started to unfold, how you first started getting into acting, and what was your kind of mindset about it all at that point?
I was 7 when my mom, who had a couple of brushes with television commercial success in the 70s, not a lot, but enough to like kind of get a taste. This is impossible today. This does not exist in 2022. But in 1979, an actor, a SAG actor, could do a single national network commercial and earn enough to buy a house.
Wow.
My mom kind of touched that a little bit, got close enough to it to sort of know what it was like, but just couldn't get all the way through, you know? So when I was 7, she took me with her to an audition, and the audition was her audition, but it was for a mother and a son. And she took me with her and convinced the casting agent to take us in together because we were an actual mother and son. We had great chemistry because she had coached me and prepared me. And at 7 years old, it was really important to me that I like make mommy happy. I did everything I was told to do, and we booked the job. And I don't know exactly what happened after that. I only know my mom's version of things, which I do not believe to be true. In my mom's version of things, I was like, remember, I'm 7. Oh, this is my lifelong dream. This is what I want to do with my entire life, and nothing is more important to me than this. In fact, my emotional response to acting is identical to the emotional response of my 27-year-old mother.
Right.
Or 30-year-old mother, I guess. Yeah. So my 30-year-old mother, right? Wow, what an incredible coincidence. So mom coaches me to go into the commercial agent and tells me this is what you're going to say. She makes me practice like auditioning and stuff. I go in again. I do exactly what I'm told, which is to tell the agent, I want to do what mommy does.
Right.
The agent's like, okay, read this copy, which I did. I had been prepared to do that. I did it well. And she was like, great, we're going to send you on auditions. So that started. I don't know how much time went by. It wasn't a lot of time, absolutely less than a year, before I told my mom, I don't want to do this. I don't like this. I just want to be a kid. I so clearly remember saying it over and over and over again. Please let me be a kid. And the language there is really important, right? It's not, I want to be a kid. It's please let me be a kid. Because my mother is so manipulative and so controlling and so just so selfish and impossible to fulfill.
Yeah.
That whatever she wants is the most important thing in the world to her. So I started begging, please let me just go home. Let me be a kid. And the majority of my childhood was getting picked up from school, never knowing. So I would leave home in the morning and go to school. And I wouldn't know. So like when school's out, do I get to go play with my friends, or am I going to go sit in rush hour traffic for like an hour to get into Hollywood, go on some number of auditions, and then sit in rush hour traffic again, probably for closer to an hour and a half now to get home. And then it's going to be dark when I get home, and then I'm going to have to do my homework, and I'm not going to get to watch TV. And like, I mean, it just, there's nothing about that that a 7 and 8 year old kid wants to do, like, at all. It just doesn't exist. Children want to play. And she just wouldn't hear it, wouldn't listen to me. Nobody would listen to me. I don't know. I guess I was probably around, it was like 9 or 10. And I thought, oh, I figured out a way to get out of this. And I said, I want to do movies instead of commercials. I thought it would be different somehow.
Yeah.
And what I was saying was, I don't want to do this anymore. And she was like, how about movies? And then managed to convince me that it was my idea to go do movies, right? Right. That I was like, no, I really want to do this. Absolutely not true.
Yeah.
Mom, I don't want to do commercials anymore. Okay, how about movies and TV instead? And then I booked some jobs and like, I mean, I was a good kid actor.
Yeah.
I was a good kid actor because I was really, really, really good at taking direction and really, really, really good at just doing what I was told. So much of what makes characters work when we watch them is how the actor subconsciously, automatically connects energetically to their character. There are actors like Meryl Streep who can just do absolutely anything because they are they're magical human beings. Right. You know, Ryan Gosling's one of those people. Morgan Freeman is one of those people.
Yeah,
River Phoenix was one of those people.
For sure.
There's just, you know, there's not a lot of people who can do that. So for me, what I was extremely good at doing was very honestly and very vulnerably and very unselfconsciously inhabiting characters who were sad.
Yeah.
Who had fathers who hated them, just like I did, who were invisible in their homes in ways that mattered. Like, the only time I ever mattered in my house was when I was like a useful tool for my mother to feel like she was getting some of that attention that she so desperately craved.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, my whole life, like I was around the same age, 7, 8 years old, when I had my first inkling that my dad was a dick. And I just kept thinking, well, if there must be something wrong with me, I have to do something different. And I really thought, okay, well, I have to do this acting thing that's so important to Mom.
Yeah.
When Mom's happy, then Dad will love me. And I stayed in that toxic, unfulfilling, exploitive cycle until I was in my 30s, and I was just like, I'm done acting. I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah. Man, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, I got into acting. I was about 6 when I did my first play. I played Tiny Tim, and you know, with me, it was different because it was something I happened to find and I loved. And thankfully,
it's so different when it's your idea and when you're like, I love this, please support me.
Yes, yeah.
The thing I loved was computer programming, and I was not supported in that at all.
Right, and that's the thing. It's like, being in the industry at a young age, and I didn't, you know, I had done little things here and there, and my grandfather is Barry Corbin, who,
okay,
you know, so I was always around the industry, but even from him, he was never, because I lived, my mom and my sister and I lived with him growing up, and mm-hmm. there was never a hint of like, hey, do you want to, you know, do this small part in this movie that I'm in or whatever. It was just, I happened to find the same passion as him. But I did observe a lot of my friends who did have, you know, stage moms or the moms who were trying to live vicariously through them. And it was as I got older and saw, you know, the path that a lot of these kids had taken whose moms were kind of in control of their situation. It was weird because some of them went on to have really good success. But there was like a weird shift because their mothers wanted them to be successful because it was something they weren't ever able to do. But at the same time, once their children did experience success, it seemed like there was like resentment on behalf of the mother that their children were experiencing success and they didn't, but it was like they're doing in the first place. So like, did you sense any of that resentment from your mother once you became more successful as an actor than she was?
No, from my dad for sure. At best, my dad just didn't acknowledge my existence.
Right.
At worst, he actively resented me, like really, and made no effort to hide it, was openly contemptuous of me. mocking me, humiliating me, minimizing my successes, really highlighting places I didn't get where I wanted to go when I like fell short of things like that. Just constantly a bully. He and my brother in the dysfunctional family, I'm the scapegoat. My brother's the golden child. And he and my brother just ganged up on me all the time about like putting me in my place, you know? And they would always say that I was, their favorite thing to say was I was too big for my britches. It's like a triggering phrase for me when I hear that now. With my mom, as I became more successful, she became more needy. The trappings of fame and attention, right? Like after Stand By Me, everything changed.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like everything changed. We moved into a better house in a nicer neighborhood. Both of my parents suddenly got fancy cars. They made me and my sister go do that awful movie, The Curse. And then Star Trek happened. So in this short period of time, I went from like kind of a working class kind of commercial actor to like famous. And I think that's all my mother ever wanted. All she ever wanted was the attention. All she ever wanted was to be able to point to like, you know, look at how many people know my name. Look at how many people pay attention to my kid. So when I was successful, she found ways, and she would deny this. And I think she believes that she didn't do this intentionally. I think she fully believes she didn't do this. She would take it from me. Take the success, take the joy, and be so needy with it that I felt like I couldn't enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had done this stuff, and it was never, I'm proud of you, look what you did. It was never about that. It was always about funneling that energy upward into whatever she needed. And you know, I have just spent so much time trying to unpack the pathology of that and the psychology of it. And I mean, like the reality is they're both of my parents are narcissists. My mom is probably close to being a malignant narcissist. My dad's the kind of narcissist who's just a raging bully. That was what I lived with. You know, as much as I didn't want to be an actor, as much as that wasn't my dream, the fact that I was on the set so much growing up that I was not in the house as much as I otherwise would have been, and especially once I was cast on Star Trek, you know, I was there 12 hours a day, 5 days a week through most of my teens.
Yeah.
And just the relief of not being around my family. And the relief of being with like my space family, was really, really valuable. I have talked about this before. I was so unhappy. I was in so much pain. I was so lonely. I was so afraid. I was hurting so much. It's just a miracle that I survived.
Yeah.
Any of.
Yeah. It's, you know, and because like holding that in especially is so, it causes so much damage as well. Not that you knew any different because you were a kid. It's like you're just trying to like get through all of it. But it's, you know, with me, my struggles were different, but it was something that I really, even to this day, struggle with. And it was I have cerebral palsy and scoliosis. So having physical disabilities, I developed so many insecurities and I was viciously bullied in high school. So it was an escape for me as well, like doing theater and doing film and getting to be around people that I felt accepted by. And you know, it was a collaborative thing. We're making this thing together. But it took so long. And this kind of is actually a perfect segue into my next question, but it took so long for me to begin to open up about those insecurities and talk about it. And because I wasn't doing that, it, you know, controlled me. Like I'd go into an audition and in my mind, I'm like, don't let the casting director see your limp. And I was constantly you know, just beating
it's just another that's another manifestation of I can't be who I authentically am. I have to be the person they think I want to be. Yeah. My life was that from the moment I woke up until I went to sleep.
Right. And it finally, you know, could be, I know playing Gordy, there were so many parallels with you and the character. And currently the show I'm on now, the creator embraced my limp once he saw it and he made it part of my character.
That's awesome.
And it's been a very cathartic experience, you know, like it's, my character is, you know, insecure and like wondering why he has to be this way. And the other people, you know, are stronger and better at all of this stuff than he is. And, it's been, you know, it's been very cathartic and therapeutic going through it. So when you were playing Gordy, you know, I'm in my 30s now, so I'm able to see the parallels and it has been a very pleasant experience. But as Gordy, was that something, were you able to realize all of the parallels at that time, or was it no?
No, okay. I had absolutely no idea. You know, you had mentioned, you had said something about seeing the other moms whose kids like didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
So I was one of those kids who didn't want to be there.
Right.
And my mom was one of those moms. But she spent so much time and energy before, during, and after auditions going on and on and on about the really bad behavior of the worst stage mom who was there and saying, I'm not like that. It is it's like, listen, I shove you into the wall every day, but I don't shove you into the door frame like that mom does. Yeah. It was like that. So I just internalized that, oh, they're awful. She isn't. I'm a smart person. I'm a great dad. I'm a good husband. Like, I love my life and I feel very confident and I'm very awake and aware as a 49-year-old man. And it is incredible to me that I spent so much of my life absolutely fundamentally believing the equivalent of the sky is not blue, even though you look at that blue sky every single day.
Yeah.
So when I was doing Stand By Me, I just did what Rob told me to do. I didn't stop to think this is my interpretation of the character. I didn't stop to think like this is how I'm bringing my personal experiences here. And it was just do what the script says.
Yeah.
Just be the character. I have been talking about this as I've been promoting Still Just a Geek because I wasn't even aware of it until just a few years ago.
Wow.
Every kid in Stand By Me, the four of us, we are those characters in one way or another, like in incredibly unconscious ways. And my first exposure to that reality was during production. Corey Feldman, I don't have any bad feelings towards him at all. We're not friends. He's just, our lives are super different.
Yeah.
What I want more than anything in this world is for him to find the just calm, quiet peace inside of himself that has eluded him literally his entire life.
Yeah.
You know, when we did the movie, he was a fucking nightmare. He was such a bully to me. And he was a bully to me just like my dad was. And my response to being bullied was to make myself as small as I possibly could, like and just freeze, you know, freeze and fawn. That's what I did.
Yeah.
That was me too. And I asked Rob Reiner one day, there's like a world full of actors. Why did you cast this guy? He's such an asshole. And Rob said, you know, I saw hundreds of actors for each one of your roles. And Corey was the only actor I saw who had the same amount of anger and rage inside of him that Teddy has. And that made all kinds of sense to me. It didn't occur to me that actors brought things to characters, whether we were aware of it or not. I was only 12. I didn't think about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then I started unpacking who we all are. Well, of course, Jerry, So there was the kid named Chance who we all thought was going to be Vern. He was real funny and likable in the auditions. But every time Jerry was in the room with all of us, we were dying. He was so funny. Yeah. And he was just so like easy to get along with. And he was just so like unbothered and just like resilient and like, well, that's Vern.
Yeah.
River. I believe that River was sexually abused. I can't prove it. I don't know if it's true or not, but just circumstantially, there is so much from like secondhand, thirdhand sources. I think he had been abused as a child. I know that a lot of responsibility for his entire family was put on his shoulders.
Yeah.
And as a consequence of that, he felt like nobody saw who he was. And adults were constantly letting him down. That's exactly Chris Chambers.
Yeah.
Everyone's decided who Chris is.
Well, even their early deaths, the two of them, like, you know, life imitating art. It's just so tragic.
It still is it is my heart in the fist of a person when he fades away at the end of the pandemic. So that's all of them. Where do I fit in there? I always said, oh, well, I just fit in there because I'm a storyteller. Mm-hmm. I like to tell stories and Gordy's a storyteller. No, Will, that's not why you're in this movie.
Yeah.
You're in this movie because just like Corey was the only actor who had all that rage, you were the only actor who knew how much his father hated him, mm-hmm. the way Gordy's father hated him. And like, let me be really clear about that. The man who is my father hates me. He does not love me. He resents my existence. If I were gone, he would be thrilled. He was never a father to me. He was never kind to me. He never held me, made me feel special, let me know that I was valuable. Never once in my life did I ever feel like I mattered to him at all. Never felt like I mattered to my mom. As me, I was really important to her as a thing she could use to feel the things she needed to feel. Then I became a thing she could use to support our family.
Yeah.
Then I became a thing she could use to get attention. And through all of it, there is my narcissist father just seething that I am drawing any attention away from him at all. And my brother is the person in our family that they both worship and adore, who can do absolutely no wrong, who is just given absolutely everything. And in many cases is the aggressor in a conflict between him and me. They blame me. I have to apologize to him for the thing he started. And my mom would do that with my dad. That's totally Gordy's relationship with his parents.
Right.
That is why I am so good in that movie. I'm not good in that movie because at 12 years old, I'm a great actor. I'm not good in that movie because turning 13, I have access to this incredible range of emotions and performances. I'm good in that movie because you're seeing an abused kid feel it.
Yeah.
And look for a way out of it. That's why I'm good in that movie.
Yeah. I mean, I watched it last night in preparation for this, and it was I've seen it a million times. It's one of my all-time favorites, but it was interesting. It had been a few years, I think, since before I had children. I have three children of my own. My oldest is almost seven. And so it had been a little bit. And watching it last night was such an interesting experience for me because my perspective had shifted from, because before I was those kids. I was
imagining. I know the moment you're talking about. I did it. It's weird. It's weird to me to know, like, oh, right, I'm 20 years older than you. Because I had that moment when my kids were a little older than yours. I was like, okay, you can watch this now.
Right.
And we watched it together. And I had the exact same experience. One of the things I think is cool, I'll tell anybody listening to this, if you saw Stand By Me as a young person and liked it, if you have kids now, it's really a different movie when you watch it as an adult, and it's especially a different movie when you watch it as a parent. It's a real different movie when you watch it as an adult who is aware that you are also a survivor.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something, you know, my my dad, I've talked about it a little bit on the podcast before, but we're very different. He was a Marine, a cop, a lawyer, very all these authoritative figures. And there were a lot of similar feelings. And it's something I've still struggled with today. But as a parent now, I like, and also watching Stand By Me, the thought of making my children feel any of those same feelings would be like the worst thing in the world.
It is incomprehensible to me that a parent would treat their child the way my parents treated me, the way so many parents do treat their children. Like, bringing a child into this world is a lot of work. It's expensive. It's time consuming. And like, this is what I believe. When you choose to bring a child into the world, whether the conception of that child was intentional or not, when you make the choice to bring that child into the world, you're making a commitment and a promise.
Yeah.
You're making a commitment and a promise. I'm going to show up for you.
Right.
I'm the only person in this world who is your dad.
Yeah.
Other people will show up and be father figures. You know, I was a stepdad to my boys. They asked me to adopt them. I am absolutely their dad. And as much as they know, I unconditionally love them and support them and will walk through the fucking fires of hell for them anytime they need it. That they don't get that from their biological dad is always going to be a little source of pain for them. And nothing I can do, and I'm a really good dad, there is just nothing that I can do to fill that up. It's always going to be there. And it's the same thing with me.
Mm-hmm.
That place, that black hole where the unconditional love of my parents ought to be is always going to be there. And like, if you're not willing to do the really difficult work of being a parent and putting a person into the world, like, you're not raising a kid. You're raising someone's mom. You're raising someone's husband. You're raising someone's dad. Like, do you not get that? Like, it's a huge responsibility. And like, break the fucking cycle, man.
Yeah.
Don't inflict your trauma on your kids. Of course it's hard. Everything worth doing is hard.
Yeah. It's the hardest thing, but the most rewarding thing in the world. And watching the movie last night, just the scenes with Gordy and his dad broke my heart because it's like,
I can't watch them now.
I don't blame you. Like, it was hard for me to watch and I didn't even, you know, live it. It was something that, like, if I make my kids feel, if I'm busy working and like they want to play and they're, you know, there's a time where it's like, oh no, I'll do it in a little bit. And then I realize I made them feel rejected. That crushes me. If like I hurt them in like on accident because we're wrestling and I, you know, they hit the corner of the couch or something, it destroys me. So I'm wondering, and also there, it is a battle. Like, there are things from my dad and even my mom who I love so much. And she's the most supportive person, but there are things from both of them that I didn't want to take on as a parent and to pass on to my children. So what are the things that you've found from your parents that, like, if any, that you've struggled with, like, trying to remove from yourself when you are focused on being the best parent you can be?
When I have felt frustrated, this is until relatively recently, for the longest time, especially when they were little, when I would feel frustrated, tiny frustrations would explode into just like massive catastrophic crises. And they didn't need to be. And that was just because I was so wound up. And when my boys were little, I had not been diagnosed with PTSD, anxiety, depression. I wasn't seeing a therapist regularly for it because I didn't know. And I wasn't taking any medications because I didn't know. And as a consequence of that, my like physical reactions to things were often way out of proportion to whatever triggered that reaction. When I decided, so two things happened. In 2016, I quit drinking alcohol. I concluded that I had been, with the help and love and support of my wife and my best friend, my kids, I was like, you know what? I am drinking too much. I'm basically a drunk. I'm a functioning alcoholic, and I am avoiding all of this pain by just drinking it away. And that is preventing me from showing up for the people I love. So I need to change this. So I did. And in the and when that was gone, it like physically, I lost like 60 pounds or something like that of just like crazy alcoholic fat bloat weight or whatever. It was insane how much weight I lost. It was crazy. But I also lost a lot of emotional weight. Mm-hmm. And I was able to begin recognizing where my reactions to stress were not helpful to me. I began to recognize where my stress reactions were like, they were unconscious limbic system responses to childhood trauma. And I had to learn how to recognize them. And I'm still working on it. I'm still working on getting both sides of my brain to talk to each other. There are still times where I don't understand where it's coming from. Like, why am I so agitated today? Why am I so anxious? Why, like, what is going on? And I will have to, like, I have to sit down and make the deliberate effort to unpack and back up and, like, look back through the editing timeline of my existence and see, okay, this thing reminded my body of a way I felt when I was a kid and unsafe.
Yeah.
And my body doesn't know this is not actually happening now. It's just a memory. And that fight or flight response that helped me survive and kept me alive and got me through all of that. It's like, all right, buddy, we're ready to go. Show us who to fight. And I'm like, there's nobody to fight. Like everything's like, we're not going to fight the remote control, you know, like we just needed to change the batteries. Right. But those sorts of things happened. Starting to recognize when I would see myself react to a stressful situation in a way where I like felt myself kind of becoming my dad or my brother.
Yeah.
Learning to recognize that was very challenging, and it took too many unfortunate, regrettable public instances of me losing my shit mm-hmm. to realize, wait a minute. I see where these things are happening and I understand why. And now I just have to like have my eyes open for it all the time. So that when I see it coming, I can go, hang on, limbic system. You don't need to do your thing. I know what's going on. It is that like active live with trauma exercise, I guess we would call it. It's a thing that I have to work on like all the time. And it kind of exists for me as a person who is like not superstitious and disdainful of like supernatural magical thinking garbage and is like heavily invested in science and neurobiology and things that can be tested and proven in a lab versus like, well, if you just wish hard enough, like, you know, like this exists in a place where I don't understand the neurology and biology of it and clearly enough to remove that fog of mysticism from this thing that is working that I do not understand. And it is unsettling that I'm just like, wow, it's like that joke from The Simpsons where he says, like, there's nothing tricky about it. It's just a little trick.
Yeah.
But it's very much, as I am learning more about what they call somatic healing and like full body, you know, reteaching the nervous system, and that book, The Body Remembers, has been extraordinarily helpful for me.
Yeah.
I've talked a few times about how like there's this, I love mythology and I love folklore, and I especially love like ancient tales of witchcraft and fairies and things like that. It all comes down to ignorant men not understanding women who knew how to fix shit. The men didn't understand it, so the men were like, "Oh, she must be a witch," you know. Like that's what it all comes down to. Okay, but there's this thing where they say if you summon a demon, it doesn't matter what deal you make with the demon. Eventually, that demon is going to win. You think you're so smart, you think you're so clever, and you think you've accounted for every single like thing in this monkey's paw contract you're signing. That demon is always going to win. So as a kid, I summoned this demon to protect me.
Yeah.
And that demon sat with me all the time. I was like, okay, I will protect you, but I'm going to extract a price, and I'm not going to tell you what it is, and you won't figure out until you're like almost 50 what the price is. And the price is that it's there to protect me, but I'm always ready to fight. I'm never not ready to fight. That's exhausting.
Yeah.
And it's also like, not who wants to go through life like that? How can you have fun? How can you be like enjoying things? So what happens is I'm going through life always ready to fight. So my response to that is, now, instead of just going out and existing, I'm going out and keeping it under control.
Yeah.
So I'm not enjoying the show I'm at. I'm keeping my shit under control, right? That's the price the demon is extracting from me, okay?
Yeah.
Well, there's this other thing. When you can tell a demon, when you find out what a demon's name is, and you can name the demon, it loses all of its power over you. It cannot do anything anymore. It just, in all of folklore, forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, whenever something shows up, and like demons are kind of just like broadly transculturally the way we describe whatever, you know, spirits, malevolent energy, whatever.
Yeah.
The instant the human goes, ah, your name's Joe, right? The demon's like, fuck, and it goes away. I had to learn to name the demon. I had to learn to name this demon that had been there forever and ever and ever. And when I did that, it made it possible for me to see, oh, it's trying to come up and fight for me, and I don't want it to. I don't need it to. I'm so much happier and so much more fulfilled and so much more just like relaxed and joyful when I am existing in a continuum of gratitude and gentle helpfulness and service to the other people in my world, when I'm being the person I need to be. That demon, because it was such an important part of my existence for such a long time, occasionally knocks on the door and is like, hey buddy, just want to let you know I'm still here whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And I have to be like, yeah, I know. I know.
Yeah. I love that. Was the best, the best I've ever heard, you know, trauma or inner demons explained. I really, really loved that. I do know that you have to get going, that you're on a bit of a time crunch.
I wish I could tell you what I'm going to work on. It's so unbelievably cool. Really? But I can't.
Well, that's exciting. Yeah. Well, then once you can announce it, we'll have to come back and do it again. But So the last question, if there is anything you want to plug, I want you to do that. But before that, since you were so gracious and opening up about all of these insecurities and being so vulnerable, I like to end on a positive note. And I want to ask you, what is the thing you love most about yourself?
Being married to my wife, Ann Wheaton, and being Ryan and Nolan's dad.
That's an awesome answer.
There is absolutely nothing in this world I love more than being Mrs. Wheaton's husband.
Yeah.
Being married to Ann is by far the very best part of being me. I love my kids so much. I love my family so much because we worked real hard to be a family.
Yeah.
And Anne's family background is similar to mine. And we both had to overcome that. Mm-hmm. And then the four of us as a family and my daughter-in-law, Ryan's wife, we have all worked very, very hard to be a family, especially the boys and us when their bio dad was such a piece of shit when we were younger.
Yeah.
We've really earned it. We built it all together and we've maintained it all together. And just like, I know that there are other people in this world who have worked to be a family, who have earned being a family, who have done, who have made the hard investments and done all of the difficult things to be a family. I am, as someone who did that, I just want to celebrate you, the person who is seeing this, who did the same thing that I did. It's the greatest thing ever and is absolutely worth all of the effort and all of the times it was hard.
Yeah. And as a dad, fellow dad and fellow husband, I want to say that truly I'm proud of you for all of the work that you have put into it. And I'm grateful that you have for your kids' sake and for your own sake and your wife's sake. Like, it's really special what you've done. And I'm really, really thrilled for you.
Thank you.
Of course, of course. And so lastly, if there's anything you want to plug, I'll let you do that. And then I'll let you go.
Okay. So I have a new memoir that is in bookstores, in audio, print, and ebook right now. It's called Still Just a Geek. And it's my story. It is my story of overcoming childhood trauma, surviving a predatory industry, becoming a husband and a father, an outspoken advocate for mental health care and mental health treatment. And it sort of chronicles my journey from someone who was forced to be an actor, eventually becoming someone who absolutely loves being a writer and a storyteller. The book is called Still Just a Geek, and everything you need to know about it can be found by looking at my blog or the usual ways people find out information about things. I would, if any of the things I've talked about today land on anybody in the audience, I think that there's a reasonable chance that you will also respond favorably to my story.
That's awesome. I actually just ordered it yesterday, so okay. I can't wait to read it. So that was my conversation with Will. Again, I'm just blown away at how open and vulnerable he was talking about his past and the trauma that he endured and the pain. And his story is just really powerful and impactful to so many people, including myself. And I'm grateful that he's sharing it with the world and that he shared it with me personally. So thank you, Will, for doing that. Be sure to go check out his book, Still Just a Geek, which I just got and started reading. It is really good so far. Also, like Will had mentioned, go watch Stand By Me again if you haven't watched it in a while, because there's, after hearing the backstory behind everything and knowing what he was going through personally, it just adds a whole new perspective, and it's an entirely different experience watching that film now. But be sure to go follow Will on Instagram at It's Will Wheaton, and that is Will with one L, and Wheaton is spelled Wheaton, and follow along with him on his journey there, and show him some love as well, because he has overcome and accomplished so much. But anyway, now is the time for me to talk to you about next week's guest. So next week, I am interviewing another one of my 1883 castmates. I've already had on Graciela Brancusi and LaMonica Garrett and Tim McGraw. But now I am interviewing one of the prettiest cowboys on the show, and that is Eric Nelson. And Eric and I, we hit it off and, you know, got along on set. But one of the cool connections that we had, a mutual friend in common, Graham Patrick Martin, who you might know from Major Crimes or Catch-22 or the Bill Engvall Show. But not only that, but Eric is married to someone named Sainty Reed, or I guess it's Sainty Nelson now. And Sainty and I grew up doing plays together. I played Chi-Chi the monkey in Pippi Longstocking, and Sainty was Pippi Longstocking when we were like probably 12 and 10 or something like that. It was a while ago. So I have known Eric's wife for a really, really long time, and it was a really cool thing to reconnect with her through Eric and to get to know Eric as well. So I am super excited for you to hear my conversation with Eric. He's a great actor, an even better person, and I think that you're really going to enjoy our conversation. So be sure to tune in next week to listen to that. Until then, remember to love your limp, be good to yourself, and enjoy my original outro music by Devin Levi, and give him a follow at Devin Levi Music. Y'all have a good one.